This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Since October, Brazil has had over 3,000 suspected cases of microcephaly, babies born with abnormally small heads and damaged brains. The main suspect, a little-known mosquito-borne virus called Zika. Zika cases have now been reported in over a dozen countries, and health authorities predict that as many as 4 million people will be infected throughout the Americas this year. So where did this virus come from, and what can we expect as the outbreak unfolds? How can we fight it? Michael Osterholm is Regents Professor and Director of the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy at the University of Minnesota. He joins us today from St. Paul. Welcome back to Science Friday.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Ira.
What did we know about the Zika before this outbreak?
Well, actually, we knew quite a bit, but unfortunately, what we knew wasn't enough. We knew that this virus surely was capable of infecting humans. It was first discovered in Uganda back in 1947, at that time primarily a virus that was really affecting monkeys and mosquitoes, not us. We saw it move through parts of Asia in the 1900s, 1990s, and then in 2007, it actually caused an outbreak in the island of Yap in Micronesia. And then in 2013, it caused an outbreak in the French Polynesian Islands, of which actually was the first time that we saw these severe symptoms, this microcephaly, or children born with two very small heads and diminished brains, as well as potential Guillain-Barré syndrome, a type of paralysis that occurs usually as an autoimmune condition. And so at that time, that was really the first warning to us that this could be serious. And then, of course, we knew that we were vulnerable to this in the Americas because the kind of mosquito that carried this virus actually was at an all-time high in populations in the Americas.
And that was that mosquito, what was it called, the Aedes aegypti?
Aedes aegypti.
Yeah.
Aedes aegypti is actually a mosquito that came over with the first settlers to the Americas. We brought it here as a quote-unquote invasive species. And then it proliferated quite nicely right up through the 1940s and 50s. And then a concerted international effort by the Rockefeller Foundation, the Pan American Health Organization, country governments in Central and South America, the Caribbean, almost eliminated that mosquito from the Americas. And then when those programs stopped in the 1970s, in conjunction with now the garbage world that we live in, with the increasing non-biodegradable garbage that we have in our towns, villages, countryside, which now becomes ideal breeding habitats for that mosquito, saw an explosion of this mosquito. And today it's at an all-time high. We have more places with Aedes aegypti mosquito at higher levels than we've ever had in history.
So what has changed in the past few months that caused this outbreak in Brazil?
Well, actually, it's not so much that the conditions changed on the ground. First of all, this Aedes aegypti mosquito that I mentioned to you actually must be kind of looked at like the Norwegian rat. It basically loves to live with people. It's an evolutionary advantage to it. It lives in water vessels, in areas that don't have running water where you have to collect it. It lives in cisterns. More importantly, it lives in garbage, one rubber tire or of plastic that doesn't disintegrate. Even throwaway wrappers that are in the ditches are all wonderful breeding sites for this mosquito. The other thing that it has as an advantage is it's a daytime biter. It doesn't bite at night, and it actually has acquired the evolutionary ability to bite us from behind. It knows not to come in to the front of us, so it'll bite the back of your ankles, your neck, your elbows, and you don't feel it biting. And so, in a sense, it's kind of the perfect stealth mosquito for transmitting these viruses. So we knew that that was there, and we knew it was in very high levels. It was causing outbreaks of dengue fever and dengue hemorrhagic fever. It was in 2013, another virus, chikungunya, was introduced into the Americas in St. Martin and spread across the Americas, Central America, the Caribbean, and Northern South America, literally within 2 years. So we knew we were primed and ready for something like this to happen. I have been giving talks for several years saying it was just a matter of time before Zika would arrive. What we didn't understand was, would the conditions that we saw in French Polynesia, this very severe microcephaly and Guillain-Barré syndrome occur, which unfortunately it has. And so now we've got this virus in mosquitoes, as well as the chikungunya virus and the dengue virus.
Mm-hmm. There was talk that it was helped to be spread by sporting events that were occurring in Brazil.
Yeah, we live in a world today where, you know, we've eliminated oceans, mountain ranges, and the biggest canyons, and clearly political borders as ways of stopping microbes. On 3 billion people crossed international border last year and in travel. And so that part of it is today, it's just like, you know, if you're living here in Minnesota, where we're always worried about the quality of our many lakes and aquatic invasive species from around the world, we're doing that with microbes, we're doing that with insects. And so it's not a surprise. It was just a matter of time. And the conditions were ripe in the Americas. And frankly, they're ripe again in Africa, the parts of Asia, to see this emerge in those areas too. So it shouldn't have been a surprise to us. What I'm worried about, though, is that we won't take the steps necessary to really deal with this. And it's going to basically be about cleaning up the garbage of the developing world, and particularly in the Americas. And unless we do that, we're going to continue to see this ongoing transmission. These wonderful pictures of people out spraying fogging areas will surely kill the adult mosquitoes in many cases, won't touch in many instances the actual breeding mosquito in these kind of habitats where they breed. And so we really have a lot of work ahead of us to stop this.
We here in the U.S. are certainly part of the Americas. Is it going to arrive here on its own? There are cases of it being brought in. Is it going to breed here?
Yeah, one of the key issues here is this particular disease is one where it's a mosquito-human combination. Other vector-borne diseases or diseases transmitted by mosquitoes and ticks actually require an animal species to be involved. In this case, you have to have an infected human, which an uninfected mosquito will feed on that human. They then become infected, and they take additional blood meals on other humans for which they then transmit the virus. So one of the things is when you have what we call basically an immunologically virgin population where we have no immunity, it's going to ramp up and spread quickly. The second part of that is, though, is where the mosquitoes exist. And in the United States, we do have Aedes aegypti mosquitoes, particularly in the southern states. There's 12 of them, primarily in the southeast. But the populations are much lower. We also have, you know, screens, air conditioning. And so it wouldn't be impossible to have some activity here. In fact, we saw some in southern Florida, the chikungunya, last year, where it was brought in a very similar manner. But we won't have the same problem. Now, what concerns us, however, is that there's a new mosquito called Aedes albopictus, which is the Asian tiger mosquito. This came to the North American continent in the 1980s in truck tires from Asia and now has spread to over 30 states. This one actually right up into Minnesota here. If, in fact, that were ever to be capable of transmitting this virus, that would really be a game changer. So far, we don't have evidence that that's occurring in South America, Central America, or the North America, but that's one that we're concerned about, and that could fundamentally change the game in North America.
When you say you're concerned about it, is there a real threat to the states, and is it just a matter of time?
I don't think there's a real threat to the states at all. We will have isolated pockets of cases potentially, particularly in the southern states. I think southern Florida, along the Gulf Coast, or along the border in Texas, we surely could. We'll get in and stop those quickly. This is not the same as we see in Central and South America. You know, we all live in a quote-unquote garbage world in the sense of solid waste, but we do a much better job of managing solid waste in this country. We have the capability of responding more. So surely we could have clusters of cases, but not the widespread outbreaks that we're seeing there. Our biggest concern are people traveling there. I mean, right now, this is the time of the year when people go to the Caribbean. And I must say, I really congratulate the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention on their very proactive recommendations about telling pregnant women or women potentially becoming pregnant not to travel to countries right now with Zika virus infection. And I think that is a very prudent and thoughtful piece of advice.
Is there a race now to come up with a vaccine against this?
Well, there is. You know, everything is always about a vaccine. And one of the problems is we always seem to be behind the game. I actually have an opinion piece coming out in the New York Times this Sunday, which addresses that issue in some detail. And one of the problems is I co-chair an international group right now looking at Ebola vaccines. And, you know, now that basically the international attention is no longer on West African Ebola, we have some real concerns about will we bring the Ebola vaccines across the finish line, and is there going to be a market for them? Because, again, we're at risk of another Ebola outbreak in Africa that's like had in West Africa. And we tend to go from crisis to crisis without ever anticipating it in advance and then completing the job in the end. And so I don't know if we're going to have a commercial interest in helping to develop these vaccines and what that will mean. It takes millions and millions of dollars, and if there's no return on investment at the end, it's not there. I also have one other concern about the vaccine, which I again, very much support the work needs to be done. But one of the conditions we're seeing, as I mentioned earlier in this outbreak, is a condition called Guillain-Barré syndrome. Some of your listeners are going to be old enough to remember the old swine flu, mm-hmm. Guillain-Barré syndrome connection back in 1976. And we've had other infectious diseases that also are related to this. And what happens is once you become infected, there is an immune response from the host, the person who got infected, that actually attacks the covering of the nerve in your body. And so it's an immune response type of disease, and that can be very serious. You get to the point where some people, they can't breathe because their muscles that basically control their respiratory system are no longer receiving the signal to fire. And that's a serious issue. We would be concerned here if the disease could do it, can a vaccine do it too? So we're going to have to be really careful here to make sure that this is a safe vaccine and that we don't actually involve risk in terms of Guillain-Barré syndrome.
I got just a couple of seconds left. Do you have a prediction for the next outbreak of a disease?
Oh, boy. I think there's any number of them. The one that scares the hell out of me and literally does worry me is the influenza pandemic issue. We have seen more activity in avian bird flu viruses in the past 2 years than we'd seen largely in the past 40 years. It's just a matter of time before we have a really big influenza pandemic, and our current vaccines today are grossly inadequate to provide the protection that we need. We need a game-changing flu vaccine. We have a number of candidates, but nobody has built the runway for those candidates to take off yet. We don't have any of them in studies that would get us close to a game-changing flu vaccine. We're still dealing with the 1940s technology. That's the one that scares me. Influenza could literally kill hundreds of millions of people in a very short order, and we're not ready.
Thank you very much for the warning, Dr. Osterholm. Michael Osterholm.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Michael Osterholm is a Regents Professor and Director of the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy at the University of Minnesota. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about the cautionary tale of a planet that wasn't Vulcan. Vulcan is all over science fiction. Well, there's a factual basis, sort of, so to speak, for why Vulcan is such a popular name. We're going to talk about the search for the planet. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Science Friday. Excuse me. I'm Ira Flatow. Last week, astronomers Mike Brown and Konstantin Patygin came on the show to share an exciting prediction, a ninth planet orbiting beyond Neptune. It wasn't Pluto either. Brown and Patygin had actually not seen the so-called Planet Nine, but they had detected its gravitational effects way out there in the solar system. I asked Mike Brown how confident he was that Planet Nine exists.
We believe it. We believe it enough that we're willing to write a paper and stand up and say, yes, for the past century, everybody who said there was a Planet X is crazy, and they were all wrong, but we're right.
It takes some chutzpah to predict a planet because, as Mike says, the history of astronomy is littered with planets that could have been contenders. And we're not just talking about Planet X. Among these many cautionary tales, one stands out, and that is the planet Vulcan. My next guest tells the story of Vulcan, its so-called discovery and demise. In his book, The Hunt for Vulcan, How Albert Einstein Destroyed a Planet, Discovered Relativity, and Deciphered the Universe. Thomas Levinson is a professor of science writing at MIT. He joins us today from Cambridge. Always good to talk to you, Tom.
It's great to talk to you again, Ira.
Thank you. So let's talk about the planet of Vulcan. So is Mike Brown right to be a little bit cautious?
He is. I am terribly excited by the news of a possible Planet Nine, and the story holds together perfectly. I actually had the chance to speak to Konstantin last week as well, and he told me, they tried to do everything they could to rule out the planet before they finally succumbed to its necessity. Those are two very good scientists, and I really hope they're right. And if I were a betting man, I'd bet at least lunch money that they are.
All right, you're buying.
But, yeah, exactly. But, nature has, many more ways to fool us than we have ways to figure things out. And that's still true even this far into the several hundred year exercise of modern science.
Well, let's talk about your book. Let's talk about The Hunt for Vulcan. How did Vulcan become part of our solar system in the first place?
Vulcan became you know, a planet that was actually listed in the planetary guides in some places for very good reasons. You know, the way you find something that you can't see is you look for its influence on things that you can see. That's how Brown and Batygin found, or think they have pointed towards Planet Nine. And that's how we discovered Neptune, when a man named Le Verrier, a great French mathematical astronomer, Urbain Jean-Joseph Le Verrier, great name, calculated the, you know, the all the gravitational influences on the planet Uranus, saw that there was, I mean, it was known that there was a residue of unexplained motion, and was able to predict where Neptune could be seen. And within 2 or 3 hours of turning their telescope at the point he had predicted, two astronomers in Berlin found it. Perfect sort of test case for the idea that Isaac Newton's theory of gravity really does hold throughout the solar system. And, you know, when you see gravitational influences on something you can't explain, that tells you you got to go look for what's out there.
Was Neptune the first time a planet was discovered in the math in that way?
Yeah, that way. I mean, you know, it was said at the time that Le Verrier discovered Neptune at the tip of his pen, and it was this, you know, it was almost a romantic moment. It was this great kind of rhetorical, persuasive triumph of the Newtonian worldview, of the power of modern science. You know, it was a big, big deal in the 19th century.
And he invented. So he invented Vulcan.
Yeah, exactly. He did, you know, and he did it the same way he discovered Neptune.
Yeah.
He analyzed the orbit of Mercury. He found what's really there. The effect he found is real, which was a slight wobble in Mercury's orbit. The point at, on the orbit nearest the sun that Mercury passes each year moves around the sun over the centuries. And it does so by an amount that's influenced by Venus and by Earth and by Jupiter and so forth. But it does so by a little bit more.
Right.
Than could be explained by those planets.
Right.
So,
that,
you know, with Neptune so close in memory, it was obvious what the explanation had to be, right?
Right. So even though it didn't exist, there weren't, you write in your book, a lot of people claim to have spotted it. So, hey, there's Vulcan.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, again, everything made sense, right? Newton's theory had worked in every application. The calculations that Le Verrier did, everybody knew, you know, if Le Verrier said it, you know, that was in the math, he was that good. It was in the math. And in fact, it is. It's actually slightly large. The effect that he documented is slightly larger than he did at the time. But, you know, he got it right. And the only plausible explanation, given what was known at the time, was there had to be this planet inside the orbit of Mercury that they almost immediately named Vulcan because, you know, with all that necessity, sort of this moral right of Vulcan to exist, people started, the first person was a country doctor who saw this little round spot, perfectly round spot, cross the face of the sun. And he said, got to be Vulcan. And people said, okay, that's Vulcan. We're done. And it just, you know, snowballed from there. People found things that they persuaded themselves were this planet. And it didn't seem to bother them that nobody could repeat the observation, right?
Yeah, you got to be able
none
to
of
do
the,
that.
None,
yeah, in science. Yeah. And the guy who finally puts the stake in the heart of Vulcan is, of course, Albert Einstein. How did he do that?
Well, the really interesting thing is sort of what there's a gap. You know, so Le Verrier publishes his prediction that Vulcan has to exist in 1859. And for the next 20 years, people find, you know, like there are at least a dozen reputable sightings of this thing. And finally, in 1878, there's an eclipse whose track goes across the United States, and a whole bunch of astronomers look for it with you know, the best instruments they could find. And one guy reports seeing it, and everybody else says no. And at that point, the astronomical community just says, we're done. There's no Vulcan. You know, we understand the dynamic of desire and the hope for it to be and the expectation for it to be there, but it ain't there. Mm. And, you know, you remember what we were all taught in high school, right? You know, in science, a single brute fact is powerful enough to overturn the most beautiful theory, right?
Right.
Remember that?
Yeah,
something like that?
You sort of hate a fact that gets in the way of a good theory, right?
Exactly. But at this point, you have an important fact that's getting in the way of Isaac Newton's theory. Vulcan should be there to explain what, you know, has been reconfirmed and reconfirmed really is happening with Mercury. Vulcan's not there. What gives? And there were a few attempts to do these, like, hand-waving explanations. Maybe the sun's fat around the middle, and that give some extra mass. Maybe there's a disk of dust we haven't seen before, and that's the mass. All these things were tried, and they didn't work out. But for the most part, for another 30 years, the scientific community, I mean, Vulcan and Mercury's sort of wobbling orbit were like the crazy uncle in the attic, you know, hooting up in the distance. And if you were polite, you just didn't notice that there was this noise coming down from up above. And that was sort of what happened with Vulcan in the sciences. You know, there was a problem with Mercury, but people didn't see it as serious or as something they really had to pursue. And finally, along comes this, you know, patent clerk. He's still a patent clerk when he gets started on this problem, Albert Einstein. And he starts working on a different problem, not the problem of explaining Mercury's orbit, but the problem of reconciling Newton's whole theory of motion with his then special theory of relativity that says things that, you know, there's actually a contradiction. I mean, for example, Newton says things can happen instantaneously, right? The gravity from the sun reaches the Earth in an instant, whereas in Einstein's special relativity, nothing goes faster than the speed of light. So there's 8 minutes of light travel time between the sun and the Earth, and that's how fast any influence can pass between them. So Einstein hated contradictions, and he started working on it, and it took him 8 years, but finally, you know, in the middle of wartime Berlin, working on his own, scribbling away calculation after calculation, he comes up with the fully formed theory of general relativity, which is a really, truly weird idea, right? Mm-hmm. It says that gravity isn't a force. It doesn't tug on you like you know, this sort of imagined sort of mechanical connection. It's actually something that is a property of the shape of space and time. And big masses deform space and time more. Big mass like the sun creates a big dent in space-time. And that explains, and you know, that helps explain how things move around the sun and throughout the universe. And that was his big conception. And the test was when he tried to apply it to a real world problem. And the first real world problem he applied it to was the problem of Mercury. And he found that if you worked through the idea of curved space-time near the great mass of the sun, Mercury's orbit behaved exactly as Le Verrier said it did, but perfectly naturally. It was just rolling down the shortest path it could travel in curved space-time. You didn't need another planet. You didn't need some mysterious effect on the sun. You didn't need to play with the fundamental constants of nature. That's just the way it was. And it was a revelation.
So he didn't set out to disprove Vulcan. It just stemmed naturally from his ideas about Mercury.
Exactly. You know, Mercury was, you know, I got into this whole story actually because of Einstein. I was doing a different piece of work on Einstein, you know, more than a decade ago. And I came across, you know, references in his letters to his extreme joy when he got the Mercury result right. You know, he said he had palpitations in his chest. You know, his heart leapt in his chest. He was beside himself with joy. He couldn't work for days. And, you know, you've been around this business long enough to know that's not the usual picture of Einstein. He's not this, you know, wild emotional type, right? And at the time, I wondered, what was it about this one, you know, because it seemed like, you know, fixing a minor problem in solar system dynamics, why was that such a big deal for him? And, you know, it was in answering that question, finally getting back to that question, that I came across this story of Vulcan and realized why it was such a big deal. It was a big deal because it showed that his conception of how the universe fits together, radically different from the one it was replacing, Isaac Newton's theory of gravity as instantaneous action at a distance, had to be, you know, really pretty much had to be correct. He was convinced of his, you know, he was convinced he nailed it once he got the orbit of Mercury right, even though that's far from what he set out to do. And, you know, the rest of the world would catch up with him when the Eclipse Expedition of 1919 measured the bending of starlight around the sun as his theory predicted. But, you know, already in the late autumn of 1915, Einstein knew.
Yeah. Our number, 844-724-8255, 844-724-SciTalk. We're also, if you want to tweet us, welcoming your tweets at SciFry. When you heard about Planet Nine last week, was this sort of deja vu all over again for you?
It kind of was. I mean, the thing that's beautiful about Planet Nine is, you know, science advances. People do things differently now than they did in the 1850s. The mathematics that Batygin and Brown, you know, brought to bear on the problem of trying to understand the orbits of these little Kuiper Belt objects that weren't behaving as expected, you know, it's much more sophisticated mathematics than Le Verrier had at his disposal. Just as Le Verrier had much more sophisticated mathematics than Newton had at his disposal. So, you know, I mean, this goes on continuously, but underneath it all, the argument is exactly the same. There's stuff out there in the universe that is doing something that we can't quite fully explain. So let's try and fill in the gaps. What could possibly account for all that? And there's a real elegance to it. And, I really hope Batygin and Brown are right, and I bet they are, because it's just such a pleasing argument.
Well, maybe, we ask them what they want to call it. They say right now they're calling it George. And maybe we could, or you could, or everybody could get a Vulcan. Right? We're looking for a Vulcan. Maybe we could just name it Vulcan and do away with that search.
Vulcan would actually be kind of cool, I have to say. I wouldn't mind if it were Vulcan. Though I have to say, it's way out there, right? It never gets closer than 250 Earth-Sun distances, astronomical units. It's cold, it's dark, the nights are long. Bacchus, the life of the party.
Oh,
that'd be kind of fun as well.
Oh, that's an idea. I'm talking with Tom Levinson, author of a great new book, The Hunt for Vulcan, and How Albert Einstein Destroyed a Planet, Discovered Relativity, and Deciphered the Universe. On Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Is that search for Vulcan, is that how Vulcan got to be such a big name in science fiction? Star Trek, all these sorts of things, Vulcan this, Vulcan that. People are always asking, as I say, to rename a planet Vulcan.
I'm not sure if Gene Roddenberry knew about the story of Vulcan. I'd be kind of surprised if he didn't, because, one of the people who wrote briefly about Vulcan was somebody that was really important to a lot of people of a certain age getting excited about science. It was Isaac Asimov.
Oh, yeah.
And I actually very carefully didn't read what he had written about this before I wrote my book, because I really wanted, Asimov has this wonderful voice in his writing, and I didn't want to get that mixed in with mine. But I'd be surprised if Roddenberry didn't know about it. But I can't say that he did.
I've been reading American history, and the name Vulcan goes all the way back to Thomas Jefferson. You know about this?
I don't.
Back in Jefferson's time, and Jefferson was a scientist. He did experiments like he and Ben Franklin, and people were trying to figure out. They were looking at the geology of the Earth and figure out where did the Earth come from. What's the geology of it? And there were people who said it comes from volcanoes, the lava and stuff that came from volcanoes. Mm-hmm. Other people were saying it's sort of a precipitate out of the ocean. It's the residue that's left over. And the people who believed in, there were two competing theories, believed in the volcanoes were called Vulcans. And they were spelled with a U. I thought it was kind of funny that that name goes so far back besides being, mythology. Sort of thing.
Well, that was a great age of clubs and naming and references back to the Romans and so forth. I can easily see people very happily walking around, maybe not with pointed ears, but very proudly calling themselves Vulcans.
Let's talk about in a few seconds we have left, the problem all the time of how long do you keep looking for something in science, until you have to give up on that idea.
That's one of the hardest questions. Einstein himself really was different from the rest of his colleagues. I remember his biographer and friend Abraham Pais once told me this, that the thing that always astonished him was just Einstein's stamina. He wouldn't stop working on a problem that he thought was interesting. And that put him in a great place to solve the great problem, his great breakthrough of general relativity. And it left him, I think, somewhat at a disadvantage when he worked on unified field theory for so long, at a time when there really wasn't the amount of data and mathematical apparatus out there needed to make the kind of progress that he would have hoped to achieve. So it's never easy, even for somebody like Einstein, to know when to hold them and when to fold them.
Yeah.
But I think with something like one thing that's happened over the whole history of modern science since the scientific revolution is we've become more and more sophisticated in defining what constitutes a meaningful result. So early on in the search for Vulcan, there was an American astronomer named Gould, I believe, who was an early expert in astrophotography, using the then new invention of the camera to make astronomical images and study them. And he did a survey during an eclipse.
Tom, I'm going to have to interrupt.
Okay, we're going to cut it off there. It's a great story.
I love you when you get talking. You can read all about it in Tom's book, The Hunt for Vulcan, with Tom Levinson, a wonderful science writer. Thank you, Tom, for taking time to be with us today. And good luck on the book. We have an excerpt on our website at sciencefriday.com/Vulcan. We're going to take a break and we'll come back. We're going to come up with someone who's a meteorite hunter in Antarctica. So don't go away. We'll be right back. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. When people ask me what I remember most about being on the science beat, well, it has to be my trip to Antarctica. It was like being on another planet. Giant ice blue glaciers, yet soaring mountains, and above all, the wonderful beauty but unforgivingness of nature. It changed my life forever. And this week I was transported right back there by some recordings Nina Lanza shared with us. She's a scientist with this year's Antarctic Search for Meteorites field team.
So right now we're paused on this beautiful white plateau. I guess it's not really a plateau because we're a little bit lower, but this is not something that you usually think of when you think of Antarctica. There's actually these beautiful folded rocks that jut out of the ice. So there's this sort of, imagine this blue slide of ice in between these beautiful jagged rocky mountains. Really a dramatic vista.
Yes, I can remember back to seeing some of that stuff, but not quite what she remembered. And for the past 6 weeks, Dr. Lanza's been in Antarctic Mountainous, the Miller Range. She's been on the hunt for space rocks, and I'm talking about chunks of asteroids, the moon, even Mars, all hand-delivered, so to speak, to Earth, courtesy of gravity. And for the last 40 years, scientists have been scouring the Antarctic ice, searching for these celestial samples. And when we heard that Nina was headed out into the field, we asked if she might make a few recordings for us of her journey. I'll tell you how to listen to them a bit later, but I want to bring Nina onto this program. She's back at home in a base at the Los Alamos National Laboratory, where she's a staff scientist. And she joins us now to debrief us on the 569 meteorites, Nina, that the team collected. Wow.
That's right.
Wow.
We're very excited about that number.
What a haul.
Yeah. You know, when you go out there, you're not sure. You know, I'm new to this project, so I wasn't sure, if I had what it took to actually find meteorites. But we did as a team, and we found 569, so we're thrilled.
Do you have one or two, you know, that stand out from the rest?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think we found some really interesting materials. I think probably my favorite one was a sample. We can't be sure, of course, where these came from just by looking at them, but we suspect it might be what's called a howardite, and that's a meteorite that we think has come from the asteroid Vesta. And so that's really exciting to be able to find a rock just sitting there on the ice that we know came from a very specific planetary body. And there aren't that many pieces of Vesta here on the Earth, it turns out. So it's a great find.
Now you
gotta, that definitely stands out.
Yeah. You got to tell me, though, if we've never been to Vesta and got a chunk of it, how do we, you know, pick the piece of it off? How do we know it came from Vesta?
Yeah, that's a great point. This is one of the triumphs of remote sensing and spectroscopy. We can observe Vesta using ground-based telescopes, and we even sent a spacecraft there recently as part of the Dawn mission, where we actually were in orbit for a little while around that planet. So we have all this information about the geology from remote sensing, and we can connect that to the rocks that we see here on the Earth. And it's one of the only bodies that we've been able to do that with.
So are the rocks just sitting out there on the ground?
They are just waiting for us to come and find them. They're just, if you can imagine that blue ice that you saw back when you were in Antarctica, and then you just look and there's some dark spots on them, and those are rocks, and frequently those rocks are from space.
And they get here how?
Well, they start off on their parent bodies or just, you know, as a leftover rock in the asteroid belt, and a big impact may hit their parent bodies and be able to shoot pieces of it out off the planet and send them into an orbit that eventually intersects with that of Earth. And so then they fall to Earth, and they actually fall all over the planet at the same rate. But, you know, 71% of the surface of the Earth is an ocean, so it'll just fall into the ocean. But we're lucky with Antarctica that it's this big white sheet covered in glaciers, and so these meteorites just become embedded in the ice and start flowing with the glacier.
Yeah.
And in some places, the glacier will run into something like the mountain range that we were in, the Miller Range. It will slow down, And then the winds, the very strong katabatic winds in Antarctica, will start to remove some of that ice, and that acts to concentrate the meteorites in these locations. So we can actually go there and find many more meteorites than you might imagine would fall in a single location.
You're taking me back, but I want to give our listeners who have never been there a sense of this. And you brought back some wonderful recordings. I want to play one from one of your very first mornings in the field.
I just want to describe some of this cold. I've done a lot of winter camping, but this is much colder and more sustained than anything I've ever done before. So, for example, I forgot to take my contact lenses and solution into my sleeping bag with me before going to bed, and this morning I woke up and they were frozen solid. Turns out you can actually still wear contacts after they've been frozen in a block of ice.
Wow. So your eyes okay. Your eyes are okay.
They see me fine. I wore them for 2 weeks after that, so no problem.
And you know, you hear the wind. The people don't realize how powerful winds there are in Antarctica. They just ablate the ice away.
That's right. That's right. We actually measured wind speeds up to about 60 miles an hour one day, which was pretty exciting to be out measuring in, let me tell you. They were blowing me over.
Mm-hmm. Let me play another recording you made from your first day out on the hunt.
So today we went searching for meteorites for the first time, and it was totally different than I expected it to be. I think part of it was because, you know, people had told me that it was going to be just driving around the ice and picking up rocks, which I think it essentially is. But we went searching in a moraine, which is a bunch of rocks that have been scoured by a glacier. And so imagine if you are looking at a field of ice, and over all that ice is just a ton of rocks of all different sizes, shapes, colors, and then you have to find the space rock in those rocks. It's a little trickier than you might imagine.
So how do you tell the meteorites from the meteor wrongs?
Yeah, great question. So I've learned a lot since I started this work. You can look for certain characteristics, but of course there's always going to be ones that are different. But in general, you want to look for rocks that have what's called a fusion crust. So that's a very thin, shiny outer coating which forms when the rock falls into the atmosphere of the Earth and heats up, so it melts a little bit. So it'll have this very shiny exterior. And then sometimes, you know, it'll break in half when it hits the ice or something. And you can see in the inside, you can often see what are called chondrules, which are these very round grains of material. So that's a, you know, very common meteorites, or would be an ordinary chondrite, would look just like that. Of course, the meteorite from Vesta that we think we found didn't look anything like that. So, of course, you know, rules were meant to be broken. So I've learned a lot from the veterans on the team. In particular, our mountaineer, John Scutt, he has seen, you know, he's been with this project over 35 years, and so he's seen more meteorites probably than any person ever. And so frequently we'd say, hey, Johnny, is this a meteorite? If he says yes, then it is. If it's, he says no, probably not.
Is it possible to find, possibly on any of these meteorites, forms that life might have lived on that place, where it came from?
It's certainly possible, although, you know, with a big claim like that would require really big proof. A previously found meteorite from Antarctica was thought to actually have some potentially microfossils. This is the famous Allen Hills,
right.
I think it's 84001.
Right.
But, you know, there are a lot of abiological processes that can make shapes that look very biological to our eyes. So we need more. We need more than just, you know, a shape. We would need chemistry, and we would need, you know, I would say like a really complete fossil. So it's not impossible. Certainly not impossible, but I don't think we've done it yet. We'll keep looking, though.
If it's not life that you're looking for, or figure that is, there's a high chance of finding, what are you learning from all of these rocks?
I mean, we're learning all about the origin of our solar system, you know, what were the building blocks, and then how the solar system evolved. And not just even the solar system, but specific bodies within the solar system. You know, we've never done sample return from Mars, which is my planet of choice. That's what I study. But we do have over 130 Martian meteorites that we can study here in the laboratory. So, I mean, we have great robotic missions. They are doing such a great job, but there's nothing like having a rock in your hand and being able to analyze it in the laboratory repeatedly and with different techniques and over time, because that really gives you a lot more information. So that's really telling us a lot about planets that we are studying right now and giving us more in detailed information.
You have such a niche job. I mean, you're a geologist, but you're only studying Mars. I mean, is there a name for exactly your job of what you do?
I guess I'd say it's the greatest job ever, but that's probably not my job title. I would call myself a planetary scientist.
Okay, that'll work for me. And you also zap Martian rocks with a laser, don't you?
I sure do, yeah. I'm part of the science team on the ChemCam instrument that's on board the Curiosity rover that's on Mars right now, zapping rocks as we speak. We have a laser that will ablate a little bit of material and at a distance, so up to about 23 feet away, and it will make a bright flash, and we'll look at the color of light that bright flash emits, and we can say what the chemistry of that rock is. So we do that probably, I'd say we do on average 400 to 800 zaps on Martian rocks every single Sol, Martian day.
Wow. You don't actually push a button yourself.
I know. I wish there were a button. I was also hoping there was a steering wheel, but sadly, it's just typing.
Let me go back to your last recording we have of you, and I think this is terrific. It's clear from your recordings that you're in Antarctica. You have to make your own fun, I know, from being down there. And here's how you spent Christmas in the field.
Are you ready?
A little splash. That one.
He rules the world with truth and grace, and makes the nations prove the glories of his righteousness, and wonders of his love, and wonders of his love, and wonders of his love.
A Christmas Carol. You brought sheet music to Antarctica?
I sure did, and a pitch pipe. Apparently the first time in ANSMET history that this has been done.
Wow. There are also recordings of you guys reading aloud from Shackleton's Journeys. He, mm-hmm. to me, was I think to most Antarctic people who've been there, is the great hero of Antarctica. Did any of that stuff he wrote about sound familiar to you?
Oh, my goodness, absolutely. It's really astounding how Antarctica has stayed the same, you know, over the last 100 years. You know, he would describe these fogs rolling in, and we experienced that, this sort of the silence and the solitude and the sound of the wind. All of that is still true today. This is really still Shackleton's continent in many ways.
I'm talking with Nina Lanza on Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Did you get to any of the huts that are out there still over?
I did get to the Discovery Hut, which is at McMurdo Station, so it was pretty easy to get to, and my goodness, I am so glad I didn't have to live there for 2 years. It was good shelter against the storms, but that is not a luxury living.
Do they still have the penguin sitting out there from 100 years ago that he was dissecting? Scott?
There's actually, I only saw a giant desiccated seal, which I didn't recognize as such until somebody told me. But the only penguins I saw were actually alive and well, thank goodness.
Yeah, that's great. Now that you have all these meteorites, where does your collection go to now?
So right now, they are on a container ship that is bound for, eventually, Johnson Space Center. So the rocks will be kept frozen until they get there. And then when they get there, they will be slowly thawed in a dry atmosphere so we can prevent any water from forming on them and then causing aqueous alteration, changing the mineralogy. And then the folks at Johnson Space Center will start doing the triage analyses. So they'll try to say, okay, what did we bring back? They can't do in-depth analyses on every single one, but what they'll do is they'll do some analyses on every one, and then they'll publish a newsletter, which is put out twice a year, saying, hey, researchers of the world, here's what we found. Would you like to do additional research on it? And if somebody sees something they want to look at in more detail, they'll submit an application to get a piece of that meteorite to continue to study.
How long have these meteorites been in Antarctica?
Well, it's hard to say. You know, we don't really know. They could be thousands and thousands of years. They could be last year. It'd be hard for us to know. Certainly, most of them have been there a very, very long time.
You mean thousands of years, and they've been covered with ice, and then the ice has been ablated, and they just pop out?
Yeah. So Some of them, right, so they fall into snow, and that snow will get more snow piled up on top, and eventually that snow will compress into glacial ice, and it will keep moving as a glacier until it hits one of these places where the ice stops moving and the wind can ablate it. So it may have been locked in ice for thousands of years before we got there. In fact, some of them we find are just sort of jutting out a little bit from the ice, and we have to very carefully chip them out of the ice because they're still stuck in there, but we don't want to touch them, so that's actually quite tricky.
They've been there for thousands of years. What more could you do to them? They've been exposed to the microbiome of Antarctica. Are you being a little too careful about pulling them out of the ice?
You can never be too careful, Ira, especially because people are very interested in seeing, you know, what is the organic content of these materials.
Right.
Some of them are very high. The carbonaceous chondrites have a very high organic component, so we certainly do not want to add any new organics because we want to make sure these came from space, so we really understand what the inventory of organics was in the early solar system.
Sounds to me like you're going back.
I think if they'll let me, if they're not sick of me yet, I'd love to.
Yeah, and back to the same place. I'm sure there are a lot more meteorites yet to be discovered.
Oh, absolutely. Although I think next year the field site will be different. They kind of rotate around, so I'll have to talk to the PIs to see where they're headed next.
Are you going to keep track of your favorite meteorites? What happens to them?
Absolutely, absolutely. I have my list, my personal favorites, so I'll be very interested to see what the initial analyses are on those.
Well, thank you very much for sharing your experience with us. It's just been bringing back memories for me, and I have just a slight idea of what you went through, but I can imagine how excited you must be and how it probably changed your life like it changed my life.
Absolutely, yeah. It's hard to explain, but you understand exactly what I mean when I say, yeah, my life has changed now.
Yeah. Nina Lanza, staff scientist at Los Alamos National Lab in Los Alamos, New Mexico. She's also a member of the 2016 Antarctic Search for Meteorites field team run by Case Western Reserve University. And you can listen to a lot more of Nina's Antarctic dispatches at our website, including her answer to our most pressing question.
How do we go to the bathroom in the field? Great question. So glad you asked.
If you want to know the answer, inquiring minds want to know, you can go to our website and find out sciencefriday.com/Nina. And a word from our friends at WNYC's Note to Self podcast. They want to help you make information overload disappear. It's their new project called Info Magical. They've got a series of challenges for you and want your data. And you can find out more at wnyc.org/infomagical. We're going to have to say goodbye. BJ Liedemann composed our theme music, of course, and we had help from our production partners at the studios of the City University of New York. Have a great weekend. We'll see you next week. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.